Hello, I'm Dominic Green. I'm culture editor for Spectator USA, and I'd like to welcome you to our weekly culture podcast. This week, I'm casting a pod with Nell Breyer. Nell is the executive director of the Association of Marshall Scholars, that's the ED of the AMS, and we'll be talking not just about George C. Marshall and the Marshall Plan, but also about the links that it built between the United States and the post-war world, and also about the United States' current relationships and how soft power can work during a presidency that likes to think of itself as hard-headed. Nell, welcome to Spectator USA.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Well, my first question is, of course, please remind me who George Marshall was and what he planned.
Very good. So George Marshall, as you know, served as Secretary of State, and after World War II was the author of an initiator for probably the largest single aid and recovery plan the world has ever seen, $13 billion of aid to 17 countries over 4 years, which, as you can imagine, just after World War II, was an enormous amount. That plan was not just conceived as money dropped and left to its own devices. It was conceived as an insurance to prevent the types of catastrophic wars and destruction that Europe had seen both in World War I and World War II.
So this was not just a political program, this was also financial and also trying to change the culture of the people who were receiving the money. There were strings attached.
So there was a strategy behind the support, and the strategy was very broad and thought through in the following ways. So first and foremost, to conceive of peace being linked fundamentally to human understanding, exchange, compassion, to stability, economic prosperity, and to shared understanding of human rights and human dignity. So those tenets were all part of the reciprocal giving that the Marshall Plan represented.
We're familiar, of course, with the massive amounts of money that the United States gave. What is the figure for that?
You mean what is the total figure?
Yes.
$13 billion in
$13 billion.
$13 billion in aid, which is hard to comprehend in 1948 terms. So you will have to do the math on the inflation.
I'm not sure
the
I
comparable
can.
Comparable value, but $13 billion in aid to 17 countries is quite a colossal amount, designed to help Europe recover from the disastrous state it was in after World War II. And of course, part of the concept was to rebuild trust and economic interdependence between these European countries in order to ensure that France, England, Germany, Italy would never be fighting again.
So when the United States is building this system, this Atlantic system, really, it's building in something political, something economic, and also something cultural. What were the forms that the cultural programs took?
So the first piece, I would say, the institutions that we associate with the Marshall Plan that were born from it directly, NATO, the United Nations, the European Union, are all considered sort of institutional I don't know, for lack of it, children of the Marshall Plan. But there were important secondary roots and exchanges that were born out of that. So I have had the privilege of working for the last 2 years, I'll give you one example, on a now almost 65-year-old educational exchange program, the Marshall Scholarship. The Marshall Scholarship is a gift that the United Kingdom had decided to give to the United States, sponsoring up to 40, originally it was 12, now there's 43 scholars to study in the UK in postgraduate research for 2 years.
So these people go off to Oxford and Cambridge and the major universities in Britain, and then they come back to the US. Can you give us some names? Because they may be hiding in plain sight in American public
life.
Well,
there are quite a few. You may know Tom Friedman. You may know Anne Applebaum. There are some wonderful journalists who write on more than just our country. They write around the globe on what's happening. There are some important leaders in the civil service and in international affairs. Former Deputy Secretary of State Bill Burns, who now is president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. There are also two Supreme Court justices, Neil Gorsuch and Stephen Breyer, my father. There are a wonderful cross-section of leaders in the arts and music. To name a few, the CEO of Wolf Trap, the wonderful performance venue outside of Washington, D.C., is run by Arvin Minoka, a Marshall Scholar. Cindy Chagrou, who is the former director of the National Scottish Ballet, is a Marshall Scholar. Odeline de Martinez, the first woman to conduct the BBC Proms, who lives over in the UK and has started a festival. And then there are a rather large smattering of scholars who have led universities, provosts, and other more, I would say, celebrity figures like entrepreneurs such as Reid Hoffman, the co-founder of LinkedIn, or Nancy Lublin, the entrepreneur who started Crisis Text Line. So you have a huge diversity, and they all shared this gift of studying overseas in the United Kingdom for 2, some even 3 years.
Now, were the Fulbright scholarships, a part of the same program, or are they a development from the same period?
The Fulbright, exactly, was developed in the same period and enables two-way exchange. So it supports not just Americans in the study overseas and not just in the UK. It supports study all over the world. But it very much was born out of that same period with the idea that experience that is immersed in another culture and another society is a fundamental tenet for building the type of compassion and soft power understanding and diplomacy that would be requisite for retaining stability in the world.
Often in Europe you hear that America's soft power after the war was a form of soft imperialism, you know, the subsidizing of abstract expressionist painting, for instance, in being exhibited in Europe, which seems to me to be a very strange way of trying to make the case, well, any kind of case, really, because it's paintings. It's not getting to the moon. Or the subsidizing of Encounter magazine or something. These are often held up as somehow pernicious in a way, but it seems to me that this the object behind this was wholly laudable in that it was attempting to create a large and free market in ideas and in exchanges between people.
So if you listen to Frank Stella talk about the early exchange, as you're describing, the sort of leveraging of abstract expressionism in a program that he was involved in, I think from the 50s or 60s, the FAPE, which is an effort to put paintings and artworks in embassies, American embassies all over the world. He will advocate quite the opposite, that abstract expressionism was born and flourished from a deep understanding of Russian constructivism and the earliest, 1910, 1920s, even earlier, ideas in Russian painting, and that the fact that there was both audience and precedence is what inspired the later American abstract expressionist work.
I would say some people talk often about the influence of Cubism and Surrealism on that generation as well. It's striking, in fact, how as an art movement, how international it was. But I mean, the arts work like that; they tend to be, across borders and so on. And so do human contacts. I mean, people tend to get on well enough across borders, but politically, of course, is another matter entirely. And it seems to me at the moment, certainly, that we are seeing something of a disconnect between the United States and its political links with even long-term allies. Excuse me. It seems to me there's a disconnect at the moment between the United States and some of its long-term allies on the political level, while meanwhile the economic and the cultural exchanges still continue.
I think that's right, and I think one of the things that we have about 2,000 alumni who have benefited from this reciprocal giving program and the Marshall Scholarship, there's a resurgence of interest in actually building those individual ties and individual networks that can cross-pollinate between the UK and the US, and obviously further implicating some of the transatlantic ties where it is not government to government, but very much person to person, sector to sector, without policies inhibiting the types of fluid exchange that are absolutely critical in the arts and culture, but I would also argue in other fields, security, data analysis, AI, understanding all kinds of innovation in science and engineering and beyond.
Obviously, you have to be a diplomat in your work. You're between the United States, Britain, U.S. and foreign countries. So I have to ask, what do people in your field, without naming names, think about the current position they're in? Are they having to come up with a plan B, you know, for how to sustain these kind of links in the face of a hostile administration that could be in for another 6 years?
So I think there is a very genuine and open effort to broaden and expand dialogue and seek lots of different, both back channel and front channel means for communicating. I have seen, you know, both embassies, certainly the UK embassy in Washington, D.C. and the U.S. embassy in the UK, express enormous interest, not just in the direct political policy negotiations, but in a lot of the private sector work and innovation work that there are shared or parallel interests in genetics and data science and all kinds of entrepreneurship and in some of the remarkable creative work that we're seeing in music and fashion and fine art.
Well, having grown up in Britain, to me, it's very obvious the benefits of the Marshall Plan and of American cultural influence. These are most of the things that made life interesting and exciting for people in my generation, and also in the generation before that, the post-war generation. But the perception, perhaps, is certainly the president's perception at the moment, is more along the lines of what did the rest of the world ever do for us? What has the United States gained from all this subsidy, all this effort, all this outreach, and so on?
You mean the past or the current?
Well, in the past or currently, yes, yeah.
I mean, I think if you talk to individuals in the State Department, if you talk to individuals, I would say both who work and understand key issues that impact both countries. Let's just take security as an example. There's a kind of side-by-side sharing of information and direct conversation that
just like in the James Bond films, you mean? It's actually there really is a Felix Leiter.
There is definitely more than just cordial communication, and there's still a deep expectation that there's a primary conduit, and despite what we see in the press, I think there's most levels of professional who work both inside the current administration and outside understand the importance of that open dialogue and direct ability to communicate.
I mean, this is the nature of soft power, that it walks softly, and so you don't often see it. I mean, some of the names you were mentioning, I didn't actually realize that they had been Marshall Fund scholars and that this had been a great influence on their development.
So I think it really has, and I think what's interesting about that scholarship in particular is the diversity of minds and young leaders who are now old leaders that it attracted. So you have people who have really helped create what I would call global ideas, taking Reid Hoffman as an example, the idea of scaling and the power of human networks. Take an example of Angela Duckworth, who really has made popular the concept of grit. She's a psychologist looks at psychology as her day-to-day practice, but has really transformed what we understand as human intelligence and the possibility of human accomplishment and drive. There are enormous number of individuals who I think take with them the experience of being in another country and reflect back in their own work the importance of bringing key ideas to a kind of a general public. And that public is not just an American public. That public is often an entirely global public.
And welcome back. I'm Dominic Green. I'm casting the pod with Nell Breyer, the Executive Director of the Association of Marshall Scholars. So, Nell, sometimes when I'm in New York, I notice that there are Brits hiding in plain sight in many of the major cultural institutions. Do you have a hit list of them in the association offices?
There are an enormous number of cultural leaders in New York and scattered around the whole country, and that has certainly been an area we have benefited from. This cross-cultural exchange, Tom Campbell.
This is the notorious Tapestry Tom, I believe, as he was known.
Former head of the Met.
From the Metropolitan Museum of New York. I believe he has been sent back to Britain wrapped in one of his tapestries.
He has been replaced by an Austrian director, Max Hollen, I believe is how you pronounce his name. There are an enormous number of leaders in fashion, in museums, in galleries, in dance, who come from overseas.
It's an interesting thing how in different art forms the numbers rise and fall. For instance, obviously in the 60s, rock music was almost largely invented by British acts, and well into the 80s, a huge amount, as much as a third of American chart music came from Britain. Much of it rubbish, of course. Nobody should be subjected to a flock of seagulls and things like that, but people were. That has fallen away in that now hip-hop is the dominant chart music. If it's not that, it's going to be country and western, and both of those are pretty much American monopolies. On the other hand, in dance, it's fluctuated, isn't that right?
Well, dance is a very interesting narrative, where if you looked at the progression from Bauhaus moving and influencing Black Mountain College and the partnership between Cunningham Cage and the influence Bauhaus had on that, and then into Judson and Fluxus and what happened in the experimentation in the 60s with an incredible explosion of ideas in dance, contemporary dance, with Trisha Brown and Yvonne Rainier and so many others, moving again away from the United States to, I would argue, in the 80s, and beyond, a kind of exodus where you had choreographers like William Forsythe, Meg Stewart, Pina Bausch, who are trained in the United States, some even at Juilliard, even Ohad Naharin, leaving the country to seek greater support from both audiences and countries that had national opera houses or national companies that could produce at scale their vision and ideas.
You hear similar things, of course, with orchestras as well, that under certain conditions, it's better to be working in Europe than dealing with the funding problems of running a major city orchestra in the U.S.
I think that's right. I think that when there are resources that are put behind a field, to the degree that a structure like the Centre Chorégraphique in France, where you had 20 or more national centers that would really become an incubation hub for creation and dance. You produce a suite of incredibly experimental artists who continue to influence young choreographers and performers across Western culture and beyond.
Would you say that when it comes to the arts, that Americans themselves could do with some kind of Marshall Plan to create another generation, a large generation of skilled or even interested young people?
I think there's an incredible creativity in the younger generation. I think that the explosion of ideas and ability to share through the internet is sort of like,
But this is all definitely the case. I mean, but one thing I hear from people a lot, for instance, is I would like to do that, but health insurance is a problem. So once they're past the age of 26 and they can't be on their parents' insurance, then this is, you know, we're talking a lot about the economic situations that make it possible to do this kind of work. That seems to put a bit of a limit on it, that it's a very expensive business now to get qualified to do something in the US, and it's very expensive to get by because of things like the health insurance double bind that people find themselves in.
I also think that I agree with you entirely, and I think that in some instances, the legal trajectories, for example, the copyright constraints around practices like sampling have produced effectively a socioeconomic strata of artists that can afford to sample in the ways that in the early era of hip hop was ubiquitous. To the rest of us that can't afford to pay that kind of royalty fee to use a clip.
I remember once in Los Angeles, someone took me out to see a giant warehouse full of old vinyl records still in their original wrappers, all unopened. And by original wrappers, I actually mean, of course, this is the purpose of the place, in that if you wanted to sample something and you wanted a pristine copy, this was where you went to buy it in order to get the one that didn't have all the kind of noises on it. And the prices were astounding. You could have bought a car for some of these because they were very rare and still unopened. And that's an example, I think you're right, that it's a very expensive business now to be an artist. Certainly also to live in the kind of places where previously, anyway, artists have lived. They tended to congregate in the centre of large cities. As we know, you can't live as an artist in Greenwich Village or in Soho or on the Left Bank in Paris.
Or even in Brooklyn at this stage.
Even in Brooklyn. That's what it's come to. Yeah, and it's interesting. When you look at fiction, for instance, there was a point when American novelists really led the field. But these days, if you were to look for a writer in English who's writing interesting fiction, you're as likely to look towards India as towards the US or towards Britain. Is there a similar network of scholarships and subsidy to encourage that kind of thing too?
There absolutely. I mean, Britain has one of the most, I would say, generous scholarship suites available of almost any Western country. It has the Chevening and the Commonwealth scholarships, just to name two, that have received significant boosts in funding over the last few years because of the UK's commitment to provide, I believe it is something like 0.7% of its GDP towards developing countries. And part of that is to subsidize these scholarships, which enable young students and pre-professionals to come and study in some of the best universities in the UK.
Do you think these kind of cultural dividends and connections are a bargain in terms of government spending compared, say, to military spending?
So I can only speak for the Marshall Scholarship, but I'll give you one statistic. The program probably has cost, I don't know, £150 million over its 65-year lifetime, and one gift, just one, from Ray Dolby, the Marshall Scholar who created Dolby Surrounds.
We'll be using it, and when we mix this.
Exactly. Yes. 50 patents more to his name, a Grammy, an Emmy, you know. He gave a single gift of, I believe it is £135 million to Cambridge University just last year, as a thank you for his experience studying at Cambridge as a Marshall Scholar. So that's just one of the nearly 2,000, and just one gift. So I would say there is no doubt.
That's a bargain.
The return on investment is highly strategic and extremely sensible.
Oh, I see. I mean, $150 million, I imagine that's buy you a couple of days' worth of coffee and snacks in the administrative buildings in Washington. So it is a very different world, of course, now to the one in which the Marshall Plan and the scholarship program were conceived. But what are the long-term goals of this, and what is it bringing now?
So I have been really trying to hear from young to old, the marshals who receive the scholarship, what do they want to give back? How can they remain ambassadors for this transatlantic exchange? And I think there is a universal commitment to this idea of a shared understanding of human dignity, of the humanistic values that underpin the Marshall legacy, and a commitment to free expression, creative expression, all the things that you associate with a liberal democracy. And I think because of the climate, actually, and because of this, if not inward focus, increasing insecurity in the impact of globalization and our interdependency, there's a recommitment on an individual level to exchanged understanding, to sharing ideas and culture wherever possible. At least I've seen this on a personal level across the spectrum with these experts and students, young and old.
Well, long may it continue. Nell, I'm afraid your conversational visa has elapsed. You're going to be deported from this podcast. And that is, I'm afraid, all the time we have for this week. This is the Spectator USA Culture Podcast, Back of the Book. And I've been casting the pod with Nell Breyer, Executive Director of the Association of Marshall Scholars. Nell, thank you for joining me and our listeners at Spectator USA.
Thank you so much, Dom.
I'm Dominic Green, and you've been listening to Spectator USA's Culture Podcast. There's plenty more arts and culture where this came from on the Spectator USA website. I look forward to you hearing more from me and us hearing more from them next week when we cast another pod on Spectator USA. Till then, thank you for listening. Goodbye.